Hello and welcome to the second episode of Dive and Dig, the podcast inviting you on an underwater journey to discover some of the remarkable archaeological finds lying on the seabed.
When you're young, you read Tintin books and you see pictures of shipwrecks and stuff like that. And then you grow up and you think, well, yeah, obviously shipwrecks aren't really like that at all. Actually, they can be better.
We'll take you down into an undiscovered world thanks to the evolving technology that makes deep diving possible and that allows archaeologists to explore greater areas with ever greater precision.
The more things line up, the more secure we can be with the dating of our shipwreck.
We'll be talking to the man behind the invention of sonar.
Sound has been used to look for things in the ocean, to detect the ocean bottom. I was determined to make one that really worked well, so that's what I did.
And looking at today's technology, which is used to investigate what lies below the surface.
The digital revolution has made an enormous difference to what we do.
I'm Bettan Hughes, and this is the Dive and Dig podcast. With me is Dr. Lucy Blue, the Maritime Archaeological Director of the Honor Frost Foundation. Now, I know, Lucy, that we are both fans of Honor Frost's work. She was an incredible woman. What a pioneer. Really one of the great pioneers of maritime archaeology.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. She was an inspiration, actually, to all of us, I would say.
And she started her diving career back in the 1950s, and the Honor Frost Foundation continues to support work in the field today. Now, I know that Honor experienced firsthand the absolute thrill of detecting clues from the past deep underwater, the remains of ancient harbours, stone anchors, and the ships themselves across the seabed of the Mediterranean. And she was working, this is right, isn't it, pretty much from 1950, uninterrupted, until she was well into her 90s.
Yeah, no, it was quite remarkable. She just didn't stop, effectively. she loved being underwater. And in fact, the other remarkable thing is that she wasn't only diving into her 90s, but she was still wearing the same kit that she had when she started in the 60s and 70s, which is, you know, remarkable, really.
What a woman. A number have taken up her baton, and currently Dr. Timmy Gambin and his team in Malta have been working on a Phoenician wreck 110 metres below the surface. They're down there for 12 minutes on the site, having to record what they find against the clock. And now joining us from Malta to tell us more is Timmy Gambin. Timmy, just thinking about how you record what you're finding when you're down there just for that remarkably short amount of time. How do you document a shipwreck of this nature at that incredible depth?
What we do is we use 3D photogrammetry. It's a methodology used throughout the underwater world, not only for archaeology, but also for marine biology, for example, and other marine sciences.
And just for those who don't know, could you explain what exactly is photogrammetry?
We descend with very powerful high-resolution cameras, accompanied by very powerful underwater lights. Lighting at that depth is crucial. We take a series of photographs to record the entire site. We take about 2,000 photographs. To record just the 4x2 meter trench, which we do every day, we shoot about 800 photographs. We actually use two specialized softwares to stitch these photographs together. And it gives us a scaled 3D model of the site.
Timmy, so exciting. Will you stay around? Because we just want to ask you a couple of other things at the end of the show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, as Timmy has demonstrated, technology has made a huge difference over the last decades, and particularly in the last 10 years, as to how we find, detect, and also document finds underwater. Professor John Adams is a colleague of mine from the University of Southampton. He has vast experience as a maritime archaeologist. In fact, he was the chief diving archaeologist on the Mary Rose back in the 1970s. He's joining us now to explain more about those early days of maritime archaeology.
We have a fragmentary set of remains that relate to a once organised and functioning machine. And that's what we're trying to get back to understanding. And, of course, the people who are actually making it and doing it.
I mean, obviously, we've seen a massive change in technology over the last decades.
I think, yes. In general, the digital revolution has made an enormous difference to what we do. Some of our original systems, like geophysics systems, you know, for detecting, modelling the seabed, recording the nature of the seabed, and seeing below the seabed with acoustics. Until the 1990s, these systems were analogue, and they weren't particularly easy to use, and you know, something that would make a geophysicist excited, you know, an archaeologist would look at it and go, that's a splodge, what does that mean? But then the digital technologies, the digital versions of these things came on, and then the resolution crept up, the graphic representation of what was really being recorded and revealed increased. The cost of the systems came down, the ease of use increased, and things that were once exotic and out of reach for most people are now within reach of most people. And so SciSCAN sonars, swathymetry, multi-beam systems, and even small remotely operated vehicles, you know, none of these were available outside of rich industrial companies or navies and things sort of 30 or 40 years ago. Now they're much more accessible. And the capabilities have just increased so much that we are able to work faster, more efficiently, more accurately, and recover more data.
The fact that you can document a vessel of such complex preservation on the scale and depth that you're working in an hour or so.
We've gone from working out all our measurements on big drawing tables and sort of plotting them out and spending weeks, if not months, producing the drawings of the surveys that we've made during the excavation season. We've gone from that to, you know, one of the guys coming in and says, yes, okay, everything's aligned after an hour or so on the wreck, sail away to the next wreck. Meanwhile, they're processing the model. And then the next day, rather than drawing the survey, we're holding up a 3D printed model of the ship going, ah, yes, I didn't notice that bit when we were underwater. It's just, it has actually, I mean, the last sort of 10 years or so with photogrammetry and 3D printing, for instance, that the way we were working those things, those technologies into the way we were looking at wrecks, completely different to what we were doing even 10 years ago.
Amazing.
It is incredible, isn't it, if you think of the leaps and bounds in changes and then back to that very early maritime archaeology when Arne Frost was working the field. Because if conditions are challenging today, they definitely were much harder then.
No, absolutely. When Anna was working, for example, on the Marsala shipwreck. This is this 3rd century vessel that she found off the coast of Sicily. I mean, in fact, in the conditions she was working were quite shallow, but sometimes working in shallow water can be even harder because you're sort of buffeted around by the waves and things. But the technologies were really quite different. I mean, the team was essentially working with just pencils and tape measures and writing notes on slates, this sort of thing. I mean, they didn't have the technologies such as cameras and, you know, digital recording systems that we have today. But still, you know, the discovery is remarkable. I mean, when Anna writes, when she first found the Marsala shipwreck, and I think this little clip sort of encapsulates the sort of excitement in a way. She says, between two piles of ballast stones, a large timber, such as I'd never seen before, emerged from the sand like the head of a primeval animal crowned with weed. The presence of a buried wreck was evident. So the excitement was still there, but the tools that they were using to discover them were certainly very different.
Lucy, just explain something to me, because when you're doing archaeology on land, stratigraphy is very important. It's a big deal. How does that translate to work in water?
A lot of people think that you don't have stratigraphy underwater, but that is not the case. In an enclosed environment, in a shipwreck in particular, you can still detect change over time. And in fact, there's a really excellent piece from Anna when she was being interviewed on a Radio 4 programme, on Woman's Hour, actually, where she describes stratigraphy, and we can listen to it now.
You do it in layers. It very much depends on the wreck. But what I'd learnt in France about wreck formations, about how you get a tumulus and then how the wood flattens out, the hull flattens out underneath the weight of the cargo, assuming the cargo is heavy, and then the whole lot becomes buried, you have to dig down it in a certain way from the top to the bottom, and at every layer you have to make a plan so that you know exactly, you can then reconstruct and put it all together again and see what the ship was like. But in on land, you date by your stratigraphy, like if you don't answer your letters and you chuck them into a basket on your desk, you know that the one at the bottom is going to be the earliest. And it's as simple as that. And they dig through these layers, and they can see the different layers. And then if they get an object of known date, like something with the name of an Egyptian king written on it, then they can work out the other layers, that was such and such a date, and the other layers were before and after, and so on.
A bin analogy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is a slightly stupid question, Lucy, but how are these sites found? Because, I mean, sometimes as we've been discussing, you can have sponge divers who go down, for instance. Occasionally, they're visible from the surface, but what happens if you can't see them from the top?
So, for example, in the early years, they used aerial photography, which can penetrate a certain depth underwater. But when you're looking for shipwrecks that are much deeper, you need technologies to access, essentially, to be your eyes to look deeper. And what we use are things called marine geophysical techniques. So these are essentially sonar-based technologies that can either map the seabed or, in some cases, even penetrate a certain depth into the seabed so we can start to detect buried wreck sites, for example. And in fact, one of the people who first worked on the key technology, or sometimes toys as I call them, is a guy called Marty Klein, and he invented side-scan sonar. This is a technology that maps the seabed. And in fact, Marty Klein, when he was first developing the technology, he used it in an attempt to hunt down the Loch Ness Monster.
We have got to hear from him.
To go back to the beginning with sonar, light doesn't travel well in the ocean, so people learned a long time ago that sound does travel well in the ocean. It travels for long distances. And so people have been using sound in various ways. They used it to look for fish. They used it for echo sounding or hydrography to determine the depth of the bottom. After the Titanic tragedy, a lot of work was done on sonar just to look at the bottom and see if you're going to come to an iceberg or a shallow water. So the sound's been around for a long time. And so sound has been used to look for things in the ocean, to detect the ocean bottom, to look at sub-bottom layers, and a lot of military things, to look for enemy submarines, to look for enemy ships. So a lot of the developments were in the ocean. So the way sound works, it's these things that they call it an active sonar. You send out a pulse, a sound pulse, and this pulse might be of various lengths and frequencies. Sometimes it's a very high frequency, sometimes it's a very low frequency, and the distance you can see is inversely proportional to the sound frequency. So a low frequency travels a long way, a short frequency, high frequency travels a short way. And you send out a sound, and then you receive echoes. And those echoes might come from the bottom. They might come from a target on the bottom. They might come from a ship. They might come from fish. They might come from a shipwreck. And you then record the echoes in some fashion on some sort of a graphic recorder. And there are all kind of challenges. The sound also can get bent. It doesn't necessarily go a straight line. So there's a lot of challenges in making a sonar and making it work properly. And I have a lot of friends who work these days. There are expeditions in the deep ocean. Bob Ballard, for instance, has a ship called Nautilus. And the underwater, the sonars, the other sensors just keep getting better and more sophisticated. So there's many, many things yet to find.
It's called the Nautilus, after my hero, Captain Nemo. But instead of physically going down, I use underwater vehicle systems that I can put down and then leave down indefinitely and stay down for days and days and days.
We're really privileged to have Bob Ballard here with us. Bob is an ocean explorer who's led over 150 underwater expeditions, resulting in really significant scientific discoveries, not to mention the Titanic.
I wanted to do something that the public would graft onto. And if I just found another tube worm or another shipwreck, that I wanted to do something that would really catch their imagination. And I think I overdid it. But that was what led me into human history late in my career in 1985 when I found the Titanic. And that was the first shipwreck I ever found. And then I went on a binge and for about 20 years. So that was sort of how I got going. But then I began to dream about a newer technology, the one I have now, where you physically don't have to go down in submarines. When I dove in the Cayman Trough, where the deepest volcanoes existed at 6,000 meters, it took me 6 hours to get down in the bathysphere in the morning and 6 hours to get back at night. So if you run the number, 12 hours of commuting to work left only minutes to actually do something. And exploration is all about bottom time. But instead of physically going down, I use underwater vehicle systems that I can put down and then leave down indefinitely and stay down for days and days and days. Because now the toys of choice are not ROVs initially, they're AUVs. Mm. These are autonomous means humans out of the loop. They're operating on artificial intelligence. So these vehicles are vehicles that operate independently, and you can program them. And we're developing that same kind of technology of swarming, that's what we call it, swarming autonomous underwater vehicles. So they're basically autonomous drones underwater. They're like a pack of wolves. No, we have the technology now. We can do it from the beach. We can go down and just throw them in the water and they take off for a couple of days and we can have a beach party and they come back. It's ridiculous what we can do.
Well, now. I'm very, very excited by this and I'm really, really, really grateful for you talking to us today. I have learned so much and I'm definitely going to buy the book Into the Deep and learn more. Thank you so much.
Take care. My pleasure.
Bob Ballard made some amazing discoveries off the coast of Israel in the form of two Phoenician wrecks. And the reason that he was able to actually identify them as Phoenician was from the sort of shape of a ship, literally lying flat on the seabed, and the amphora typology, the types of amphora that they were carrying. I'm no expert on amphora. In fact, I'm not necessarily a great fan of them, if I'm perfectly honest. But I'm going to welcome Dr. Stella Domestica from the University of Cyprus, who absolutely knows more about amphora than anybody would probably want to.
Thank you, Lucy. And I'm really excited that I'm talking to you in particular about my favorite subject. Well, amphorae, usually people do call them transport amphorae. And they had this distinctive shape. Their shape is more or less standard. They have a narrow neck or a narrow mouth. They are oval-shaped or conical, their body with wider shoulders, and then the body is narrowing toward the base and with two handles either on the shoulder or from the neck to the shoulder. That's the typical transport amphora shape. Because they were stowing them in tiers, then they were using this very narrow base to wedge the upper tier containers among the shoulder or the neck of the lower tier ones.
So, okay, these amphora are made from pottery, from ceramic, but presumably there are certain types of clay that is good for making pots and others. I know that different amphora take on different shapes. How does this, you know, we're thinking about quite a long duration of time coming from different parts of the Mediterranean. So presumably after a while, you could sort of distinguish where your wine or your oil was coming from by the different ceramic or the shape of the amphora.
The typology is the way we classify the different containers according to their shape mainly, and if we know more their fabric and provenance. We have to understand which pottery tradition these containers belong to so that we have a first impression where they come from and how they date. And as we, in archaeology, we have managed to map these different trends and manufacturing details that could tell us that an amphora could come from the Aegean or could come from the Central Mediterranean or could be Bronze Age or Roman period. So we pay attention to these details and we create typologies and we use them for our first classification and dating.
Tim is back to talk about some of the truly spectacular finds from this particular site. Timmy, we've heard of the Phoenicians. We know that they were great traders. They sort of stitched together the Mediterranean. And I understand that you found a cargo vessel. So do we know specifically what this particular ship was trading?
This is a typical, or what I, if one had to ask me to imagine or to describe a typical Phoenician cargo ship, I honestly would have described it exactly like the shipwreck that we found, even before finding it. Why? Because it's got at least 14 types of ceramic containers. It's got of various sizes. It's carrying grinding stones. So I can just imagine the merchants on board saying, okay, we can buy a little bit of this here because we're going to make a profit there. Then over there, we'll buy some more of wine, for example, and transport it across the sea. You can really sort of picture this kind of Phoenician merchant mentality, so to speak, just by looking at the wreck. Now, of course, by excavating it and then studying the results of the excavation, we can start to really beef up these thoughts. For example, we know that some of the amphoras were carrying wine. How do we know this? Because some of the amphoras are lined with pitch. Now, we know that amphoras carrying wine were lined with pitch so that the wine would not lose its taste or take on a bitter taste when it comes into contact with the ceramic. We were recently sieving one of the amphoras, because the amphoras, once we bring them up, are full of clay, and found the bone of a lamb. Now, we've got to get this tested, make sure that it's from the same shipwreck and wasn't sort of thrown into the sea by a fisherman on the surface a few hundred years later. But I'm pretty sure that it's from the same date. And we know that from the same period in Sardinia, excavations on land are uncovering amphorae filled with baby goats, with the bones of kids and lambs. So now we're starting to see how our shipwreck fits into this network the Phoenician network of the central Mediterranean. So the implications of what we're studying go far beyond this 12 by 5 meter site.
So fascinating, just proving the dynamic nature of archaeology, that the story and the picture is always changing. Well, in the next programme, we'll find out a bit more about exactly who the Phoenicians were and take a journey to one of their centres of operation, Lebanon. Plus, we'll be catching up with Timmy again on location in Malta, so do join us for Dive and Dig, a podcast made by the Honor Frost Foundation, the charity that promotes maritime archaeological research in the Eastern Mediterranean. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.